strengthened, so it will perhaps not feel quite that pleasant. A much better day, by and large, on Wednesday. A case of sunny spells, a few scattered showers, but still quite cool. Temperatures 13 to 16 Celsius. That's your weather.
Thanks, Louise. Louise Lear at the BBC Weather Centre. This is BBC Radio 4. Now it's time for a cautionary tale of poison, betrayal and greed. Julian Reintat reads part one of our new book of the week, The Inheritor's Powder by Sandra Hempel.
As the October of 1833 gave way to November, the amateur forecasters trying to predict the coming season for the part of Kent where George Bodle's farm lay were finding their task more confusing than usual. The outgoing month had been mild and mostly dry, just broken once or twice by heavy rain and thunderstorms. But oddly, the swallows, swifts and sand martins had left sooner than usual. On the evening of Saturday, the 2nd of November, a two-seater carriage rattled along a country road in the faint light of a waning moon. Dr. John Butler was on his way to George Bodle's farm in response to an urgent message. The flat-fronted, 10-room brick house stood on the main road through Plumstead Village, an imposing landmark among the ramshackle cottages and pig pens. Like its owner, the building was solid and comfortable rather than elegant. Opposite the house, on the other side of the high street, the farmer's crops rolled down towards the river, giving an uninterrupted view across to the Essex countryside on the far bank of the Thames. After a lifetime of thrift and hard work, George Bodle had transformed himself from a tenant farmer into a major landowner and a wealthy man. Despite his steadily growing wealth, he never aspired to gentility, but continued to dress in the rough clothes of the practical farmer and to follow the old country ways. By November 1833, George Bodle possessed some 40 acres of freehold land, along with the cottages and barns that stood on them, a farmhouse with adjoining orchards, market gardens and outbuildings, livestock and grain stores, and £3,000 of stock at the Bank of England. In all, he was worth about £20,000, which is slightly over £2 million in today's money. At 6 o'clock on the morning of Saturday the 2nd of November, All Souls' Day, in a cottage at the end of the track through George's orchards, young Mary Higgins came into the kitchen to start her chores. Mary was servant to George Bodle's son, 47-year-old John, known to everyone as Middle John, and his wife Catherine. A large fire was already burning in the grate, and a figure sat by the hearth. It was not Middle John, but his son, Young John. Slim, with dark brown hair, a sallow skin and hazel eyes, Young John was an attractive man, despite the scattering of small pits on his face, common at a time when diseases such as smallpox were prevalent. Charming, as well as good-looking, he presented an altogether more refined figure than the working country people around him. But his friendly nature meant that most of Plumstead was happy to forgive him his aversion to work and his vanity over his appearance. Middle John itched to make his son take off his fashionable jacket and roughen the skin on his soft hands. Yet young John lived the life of a gentleman, with free board and lodging and handouts from his mother's housekeeping money. Meanwhile, up at the farmhouse, another maid of all work, Sophia Taylor, was running late with her duties. It had gone 7 when she was making up the fire in George's kitchen. Back at the cottage, Mary Higgins heard young John pick up the milk can and set off at a run to his grandfather's house as the sky began to lighten. He had been collecting the milk for about a fortnight. The visits had started out as a joke between him and Sophia, the girl encouraging him with flirty invitations. But Sophia was in an irritable mood that morning, so he stayed just long enough to fill the kettle for her and lift it on the crane over the fire before heading home. At 8:30, the old farmer came down with his keys to open the cupboard. He measured out the daily coffee ration from the wide-mouthed jar it was kept in, and locked it away again in the cupboard as he did every morning. There was just enough coffee for that day. With the price of sugar only 5p. 3/4 a pound, and coffee at 1 pound and 7 shillings, the sugar was only locked away at night. Sophia made toast in a large pot of coffee with the water from the kettle. The pot was quite clean, and was never out of Sophia's sight. George's wife Anne, who was very frail, had her breakfast in bed. She had one small cup of coffee that morning, and George, breakfasting alone in the kitchen, had his usual half-pint bowl. After the master had finished his breakfast, Sophia and Betsy, Anne's step-granddaughter, topped up the coffee pot with more water and re-boiled it. The coffee grounds were then left in the pot in the sink as usual, ready for a third recipient to collect. And so began a chain of events that was to enthrall the country for weeks. The drama made such an impression on one local man that 50 years later he recalled, "To this day, I cannot look without a shudder at the big square house in Plumstead Village." The charwoman, a 49-year-old widow called Judith Lear, found a sorry scene when she arrived at the farm that morning. Every day after breakfast, Mrs. Lear came to the back door to collect some milk and the Bodle's coffee grounds for her daughter Mary's family. Mary was married to a local farm labourer, and such was their poverty that she would boil up what was left of the Bodle's coffee after it had already been boiled twice to make a hot drink for her children. That morning, Mrs. Lear found Sophia and Betsy, pale and ill, with stomach pains, vomiting, and with a burning sensation in their throats. After sympathising with the young women, Judith Lear tipped the coffee grounds from the bottom of the pot into her jug and set off along the main Plumstead Road towards her daughter's house, where she left the coffee on the table. No sooner had she got back to her own tiny cottage, however, than a tottering Betsy arrived to summon her back to the farm, saying that Mrs. Bodle needed her urgently. Mrs. Lear found the old lady in her bedroom, clearly ill. After setting her mistress back in bed, Mrs. Lear went down to the kitchen, where she found George Bodle, sitting at the table in as bad a state as his wife. He said he couldn't think what had occasioned it. He had eaten nothing for supper but a roast potato and had only had coffee and toast for breakfast. And there was something else. He said his eyes were very dim. He wondered whether something might have been wrong with the water used to make the coffee. He said he was sure there was nothing amiss with the coffee because no one had had access to it apart from himself, and he asked who had been to the house that day. He then told the charwoman to make sure that the kettle was thoroughly scoured and scrubbed before it was used again. At around 6:00 that evening, the old man's son, Middle John, arrived at the farmhouse and found his father still in the kitchen, where he had been sitting all day, still extremely sick. When Dr. John Butler began examining his patients and heard their tale, he was struck by the similarity of the cases. Not just the symptoms, but the way everyone had fallen ill within minutes of having breakfast, and the fact that they had all consumed the same toast and coffee. The old man was particularly affected. As well as pain, weak eyesight, vomiting, and diarrhea, his mind seemed disturbed. "I found him exhausted, languid, and feeble," the doctor said. "He appeared to be labouring at the same time under great anxiety, and his intellect seemed to be much impaired." As a result, Butler's medical prognosis was not encouraging. "I was of the opinion that an old man would not rally or recover from it." The Bodles were, he was sure, suffering from the effects of an irritant poison, and at the top of his list of suspects was arsenic trioxide, more popularly known as white arsenic. Arsenic is present everywhere, in the crust of the earth, in space, in the sea, in spring water, in mountains, and also, in tiny traces, inside the human body. In the natural world, it is usually found in combination with other elements, such as sulfur and iron, as in the silvery white arsenopyrite, the orange-red realga, and the golden-yellow orpiment, all of which are highly toxic. Such is the beauty of their deep glowing colours that even after the dangers were discovered, realga and orpiment were still used for centuries as pigments in paintings, textiles and cosmetics, and to decorate buildings. In 19th century Britain, however, everyone's favourite deadly pigment was a rich, vibrant green. In 1775, a Swedish chemist had developed Scheele's green or copper arsenic, a compound of copper, arsenic, hydrogen and oxygen. Soon, green pigments containing large amounts of arsenic were everywhere, in paints, wallpaper, fabrics, soap, toys, sweets, cakes and candles, making it hard to avoid touching, inhaling or swallowing the stuff in one form or another. White arsenic is the most innocuous looking of powders, tasteless, odourless, resembling at a quick glance flour or sugar, and easily dispersed in hot food and drink. It is also fatal in tiny doses, and in Britain in 1833, it was cheap and ridiculously easy to get hold of. To unleash its attack, arsenic has to be absorbed into the bloodstream, so there is normally a delay of 10 minutes or so, longer on a full stomach, before the victim starts to realise that all is not well. Then comes tightness and a burning sensation in the throat and gullet that makes it hard to swallow. As the poison enters the bloodstream, the blood vessels become inflamed, affecting the digestive system, causing stomach cramps and nausea, followed by violent vomiting. Death can take anything from 2 hours to 4 days, though victims can linger for a fortnight. Arsenic poisoning was impossible to diagnose until the late 1700s, and even then the process was distinctly hit or miss. Medical science was unable to distinguish its symptoms from those of common illnesses, such as food poisoning and dysentery, often known as English cholera, which were common at a time when food hygiene was poor and living conditions often appalling. The English usually cleared up inside a few hours and was regarded with a familiarity almost bordering on contempt, unless the attack was particularly severe. Cyanide and strychnine dispatched their victims in a predictable manner. Arsenic, by contrast, is mysterious and shilly-shallying, behaving more like an infectious disease. Even if arsenic did come under suspicion, there was nothing resembling a reliable test to confirm its presence. If John Butler was right in his diagnosis of what was ailing George Bodle, then the old man was facing a dreadful end.
Julian Reinhardt was reading from The Inheritor's Powder by Sandra Hempel, abridged in 5 parts by Libby Spurrier. It was a peer production for BBC Radio 4. The producer was David Blount. Now, before the shipping bulletin, we're sailing by. Now, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Tuesday, the 17th of September. There are warnings of gales in Viking, North Atsira, Forties, Cromarty, Forth, Tyne, Dogger, Humber, White, Portland, Plymouth, Sole, Lundy, Fastnet, Irish Sea, Shannon, Rockall, Malin, Hebrides, Bailey, Fair Isle, Faroes and South East Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800. Low, North Fair Isle, 974, slow moving, filling 980 by 1800 Tuesday. New low expected England, 993 by same time. The area forecast for the next 24 hours. Southwest Viking, southwesterly, veering westerly 5 to 7, occasionally gale 8 in south, squally showers, moderate or good. Northeast Viking, North Atsira,